supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hey, picture this. A soldier returning from deployment who has PTSD and or problems with substance abuse, depression, anxiety, or maybe even homeless. Now, who do you see? Is it a man? Because returning women veterans have all of these hardships, but at a much higher incidence than men. Not only that, but many of these women have experienced sexual assault while they were in the military, and many, when they do return home, are single parents. We are honored today to have two veterans here to share their personal experiences with us. We're happy to welcome back Jennifer Crane, who came on our show in 2009, soon after she returned from deployment in Afghanistan. Jennifer, it's really good to see you again.
It's good to see you, too.
We also have Tiffany Johnson. She's an Air Force veteran who has taken part in a multimedia art project to help explain the needs of recently returned soldiers to healthcare providers. Tiffany, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks so much for coming out.
Thank you.
We've also got three experts joining us to offer insights on their clinical perspective. One is Dr. Amy Street. She's the acting director of Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD at the VA. Amy, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And we have Dr. Brianna Nelson-Goff. She's a professor at Kansas State who specializes in PTSD, in particular focus on military families. Brianna, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Janice Krupnik, she's a professor of psychiatry and the director of the Trauma and Loss Program at Georgetown in Washington. Janice, hi.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
And our phone number is 888-477-9499. Jennifer, let's start with you. When we spoke with you in 2009, if you'll recall, you had to take medication to get on the show, to get through the show. And even when you took the medication, you looked uncomfortable inside your skin. Doesn't look like you took anything today.
No. I've actually been off of my medication for almost 2 years now.
And I have to tell you, I am distracted by how good you look, how clear your eyes are, how present you seem.
I am. It's a completely different life.
Yeah, I want to hear details. But first, I want to review for our guests. We're going to play back a tape from when you joined us in 2009. Let's listen to a piece of that interview from 2000.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. How were you about 10 minutes ago when you were listening to Matthew and Patricia?
Not wonderful. I actually ended up having to take some of my anxiety medication.
What was happening?
Just listening, I think it's probably one of the first times that I've actually heard two civilian doctors come out and they hit the nail right on the head. Everything, you know, Dr. Freeman talked about the different stages and everything he mentioned I've been through. And when we start talking about that, I kind of start going back in my head and remembering everything that I've been through. And it's stressful.
You came back from Afghanistan when?
2003.
How were you?
When I came home?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, when I came home, I was very sick. I was actually medevaced out of country. I had lost a significant amount of weight, started suffering from depression during my deployment. And by the time I came home, I was not able to eat. I wasn't sleeping. I got out, and within about a month, I was having night terrors and sweats, and then I've started using drugs to keep me from having to sleep and experience those nightmares again. So I definitely was completely different than I was when I left.
What did you do? Did you seek help?
At first I did. I actually went to the Coatesville VA here in Pennsylvania, and I went there and I saw a therapist. She was actually a social worker at the time, and I wasn't pleased with the therapy that I received there. I wasn't comfortable with her. I didn't feel like she understood me. They also pretty much told me at the time they didn't really know what to do with some of the female veterans coming back because it was something they hadn't experienced. So after about two sessions, I stopped going. I decided that I was all alone. There was nobody that could help me, and I walked away.
In a way, you were re-traumatized.
Absolutely.
So you walked away, and then what?
I not only walked away from therapy, but I walked away from all my friends, my family. For the next couple of years, I ended up using drugs to try and self-medicate because I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't have any friends that were military-related that could understand me. I also didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't know what was wrong with me to begin with.
So you were ashamed?
Very much so. Very much so. I was a completely different person when I came home. It was somebody I didn't recognize. The relationship I was in fell apart. He didn't know who I was anymore. I completely pulled myself out of my family. They would look at me, and I was the same person, but, you know, inside I was completely different.
Do you mind telling us a little bit about what you experienced in Afghanistan? And if you do, we don't have to talk about it.
Sure. I'm not going to go into extensive detail, but I could tell you little bits and pieces, at least the parts that have been extremely difficult for me to deal with. I think probably what impacted me the most was that when I went overseas, we had just started the war in Iraq, and I actually deployed within days of us starting that war, and there was no focus on Afghanistan. Nobody heard what was going on. Everybody assumed that it was very quiet and, you know, it wasn't considered a danger zone at this point. So that was difficult, you know, being there and knowing what the reality was and seeing that nobody back home thought that, you know, nothing was going on. While I was there, I worked for base operations. I was a paralegal, so I worked in the main building where all of our security teams, all of our engineering teams, all of our colonels and generals were. We were also the building that the Taliban liked to attack. So within 2 weeks of me being there, we would have mortars coming over our flight line, trying to blow up my building. It was a pretty common occurrence. On top of that, we had a lot of suicide bombers that would come and they would blow up the buildings right outside of our base. And at our base, we had what they called the intensive care worldwide, where we treated not only our soldiers, but also local nationals.
Jennifer, what happened to you when you were over there, when that was happening? What happened to you?
Nothing at that moment. At least I didn't think so at the time. I shut down. The first time we were ever attacked, I was running around. I was just, you know, I have to do my job. This is what I need to do. And then when it was over, I didn't really have a response to it.
What do you mean when it was over? When that particular day was over?
When that particular incident
event
was over.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. When I really didn't have a response at the time. I can remember calling my family and telling them, yeah, no, yeah, this is what happened. I'm okay. Everything's fine. And very much blew it off. I don't think I realized at that moment that I actually was just internalizing everything. I know that now, but in order to do your job as a soldier, you learn to just shut down. You'll get killed if you don't.
So that was Jennifer speaking with us 5 years ago in 2009. I have to tell you, Jennifer, and you, Tiffany, I listened to that again about an hour ago, 2 hours ago, and I was fine. I mean, I thought it was compelling. But I listened to it now in the presence of both of you, as I watched both of you being so moved and I watched you breathing got more shallow, and you looked at each other, kind of this knowing, and all of a sudden, I don't know what to say, which sucks when you're hosting a radio show, you know? Jennifer, what was it like for you listening just now?
Interesting. I think more so because of the way I presented it and what I was saying versus the story itself. You know, I could hear how numb I was in my words and in my voice, and I probably even looked that way, I think, at the time.
There was a point when you were listening when you looked tearful.
Absolutely. Well, it's you relive it every time you hear it and every time you speak it, but it is extremely therapeutic to do so, which is why I continue down that path. But at the same time, it's like looking back into a past life. It kind of feels like an out-of-body experience, like it's not even my own when I think about it and I speak about it. And all the pain that came along with that. I mean, you feel it every time you say it.
This time, you feel sadness.
Yes.
I wondered what you were sad for or about.
That's a pretty good question. I'm not even sure. I'm really not. It's so hard looking back to the way my life was 11 years ago and realizing that, yes, that was me. Yes, this did happen. And where I was then and the person I was, just that eats me up inside. I struggled with that for a long time. And who I am now is so vastly different and so far removed that it's hard looking back and remembering that that's still a piece of me.
Tiffany, before we even get to your story, what was it like for you listening? Listening, sitting next to Jennifer.
It brought back some memories from the base that I was on. I was deployed to Balad Air Force Base. Each time that I went two times. And it recalled a memory where we had an incoming attack and a mortar landed in a coworker's pod. That's our living space, our living area. Mm. Fortunately, she wasn't there when the mortar came in and hit her living area, but definitely close to home.
Mm. Let me come back to you, Jennifer, before we talk to our experts. You wrote a very powerful article in Marie Claire magazine. You're nodding, you remember it.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 2009. It started off, and maybe we can get a link to that article on our webpage, but it started off how you were living in your car.
Yep.
How did you wind up in your car?
Just everything that happened when I came home. Like I had mentioned in the previous interview, I came home and within a month I had started using drugs. I completely isolated myself from everybody that I knew, and I had nowhere to live. I mean, I left the boyfriend. The family wouldn't let me stay at home because I wasn't sober, and that wasn't okay with them, which, I mean, for very good reason. But so I ended up, you know, in and out of my car, and that was just a constant thing for 3 years. And that was kind of the end, towards the end of my story. You know, that was how it ended.
I've got to tell you the most upsetting part of the article, and there's a lot of upsetting parts of the article, was when you were actually put out of your treatment
mm-hmm.
at the VA the second time mm-hmm. you got into treatment, and you felt it was helping you. And you begged them to keep you, but they said there was only two women in a group of men, and they felt that you were distracting the men.
Yes. I can vividly remember that moment, and I can remember literally dropping to my hands and knees and begging them to not release me. And they told me that they felt that the program was hurting me more than helping me, and I was a distraction to the other patients. And like you said, there was only two of us, two females on the unit. Now, again, this was in, you know, 2006 is when this happened. But now they've made huge advancements and huge changes. So they actually have a program specifically for women veterans now. It's a six-month program, inpatient. You live there, you're with all of the women vets, and you're getting the care that you need. They just did not have that available and established yet when I was there. So, yes, it was extremely traumatic. And that moment, that event where I left the VA not feeling like if they couldn't help me, then nobody could, and just wanting to kill myself, that led to the next 3 months, which was the worst 3 months I've ever experienced.
That's when you wound up in your car.
Yeah.
And we're going to hear details after our break, but somebody reached out to you and helped get you from there to here. And I hear that over and over and over again by people who have gotten through trauma and reclaimed their lives. Everyone says there was somebody there when I needed them, somebody who believed in me, always. So I want to get to know you a little bit, Tiffany. First of all, how are you being on the show today?
I'm good.
You're good?
Yes.
Yeah. A little nervous.
A little nervous, yes.
Yeah. Is there anything we can do to help make it less nervous for you?
No, sir, but thank you.
Sure. So how can we get to know you best? Tell us, you were deployed twice?
Yes, I was deployed the first time in 2007, January 2007, and I came back in May 2007. I was deployed to Iraq. And then the second time was September 2008 through January 2009 to Iraq again.
Did you see combat?
Well, my job was supply. So we issued out, you know, individual parts, uniforms, things like that. We also issued out plane parts. However, Balad Air Base is only so big. So where I was in the supply unit, we were like not even a mile away from the wire, you know, the fence surrounding the base.
And
so, no, I didn't see combat, but I felt I was close enough to the outside, too. It was close enough.
You were traumatized over there.
Yes, sir. So it was just definitely experiences that I've never, you know, experienced before. You know, incoming mortar attacks on the base, having to fall out to your, you know, shelter in place, and it was just a really scary experience. But then even in addition to that, I am a single parent, and I was a single parent my whole military career. So I'm not over there just being an airman taking care of the mission. I'm also worrying about my daughter, who was 6 the first time I deployed and then 7 the second time. You know, I have to make sure that, you know, she's taken care of.
I want to talk much more about single mothers after our break.
Okay.
But I do wonder, was that a distraction? I mean, were you able to focus on your work? And I wonder if that contributed to your traumatic experience.
I'm not sure if it contributed to my traumatic experience. It's just something that I had to do. So for the 9 years that I was on active duty, it was like the mission and my daughter. Those were my full-time jobs.
When you look back, what happened to you over there? What happened to your mind, to your life?
Well, like I said, I definitely encountered experiences that I had never experienced before. The first time that I went, it was just a shock to be in that environment and actually see what was happening outside of, you know, the media's portrayal of what happens in a war zone. The second time I went over there, it was just as traumatic as far as, like, you know, what happens on a military base that's being attacked, or, you know, the 24/7 operations. But I was blessed to encounter a group of friends who was actually, you know, they were my family away from home. And I don't know how exactly to explain, but maybe Jennifer knows the intensity of relationships mm-hmm. that you build in those war zone areas.
I do.
Yeah. And so do you have PTSD?
I do, but it's not just from my war zone experience. Like I said, I was active duty for 9 years, and there's a lot that happened during those 9 years.
Would you be comfortable saying some of it? If you're not comfortable, please don't
Okay.
Don't feel obligated to, please. Only what you're comfortable.
Right. To generalize, what I want to say is that there was a lot going on. There was a lot taking place in my life. And when you go into the military, as young as some people do, you know, that is your family away from home. You have a chain of command, people that are responsible for you, so to speak. And so I had a lot of things going on in my life. And even though people could see that I was going through a depression or there was things wrong with me, nobody address that. As long as I could report for duty and do my job, that was all they were concerned about.
Yeah, and I see Jennifer nodding. Yeah. So let's take a break. We've got three very bright people who want to join our conversation, who hopefully can shed some light on this. We're talking about what happens to female vets when they come home, when they're deployed, and when they come home. We've been talking with Jennifer Crane and Tiffany Johnson. When we come back, they will continue with us, and we'll also be joined by Drs. Amy Street, Brianna Nelson-Goff, and Janice Krupnik. Street is Acting Director of Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD. It's part of the VA. Goff is a professor at Kansas State who specializes in PTSD with military families. And Krupnik is the Director of Trauma and Loss Program at Georgetown Medical Center. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about female vets, what happens to them when they're deployed and when they come back. I want to start with you, Amy. We talked with Jennifer about living in her car and living on the streets. I said in the opening on my billboard that there's nearly 3,500 female vets living on the streets, most of whom have some form of psychiatric disturbance, whether it's PTSD, substance abuse, or others. Does the VA have programs for homeless women?
We do. Obviously, homelessness among veterans, whether they're male or female, is of great concern to us and the VA. But there's also an understanding that women veterans in particular may have some unique needs. And so we do have homelessness programs that are specialized for women veterans in hopes of meeting their more gender-specific needs.
Like what? What unique needs?
Increasingly, I think we see among the OAF cohort of veterans, those who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, that the experiences of men and women while deployed are more similar than they've ever been before. Women are being exposed to combat in the same way that men are. Tiffany provided a great example of, even if you don't have a combat MOS if your job is not specifically a combat job, but perhaps a combat support job, when you're deployed to a war zone, you're still likely to be traumatized by the combat activities that are going on around you. So we have some awareness that men and women's experiences while deployed are increasingly similar. But women are also confronted with some things that are unique for women veterans, or at least more common among women veterans. And the thing that comes most importantly to mind, I think, are experiences of sexual harassment or sexual assault experienced during military service.
There's even a label for that now. It's called MST, Military Sexual Trauma.
That's right. That's the term that the VA uses to refer to either very severe experiences of sexual harassment or experiences of sexual assault that happened during military service. And so when we're talking about PTSD among women veterans, particularly women who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, PTSD may be secondary to combat exposure. It may be secondary to military sexual trauma. There may be other experiences, traumatic experiences during civilian life that also contribute to the experience. So when you're looking at women veterans, they have some experiences that are much like the experience of our male veterans, but some that are unique to them.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's something about the experience of being a woman, the way they experience trauma, if the experience of this kind of trauma is different for men versus women. Maybe Janice Krupnik, you can shed some light on that.
Well, I think one of the things that may be unique for women also is that even prior to military service, in civilian life, they certainly would have been at higher risk for sexual harassment and sexual assault. And so, if they come in with those kinds of histories in particular, and then they experience military sexual assault while in the military, which of course is not unique to women, but far more prevalent. That there would be greater risks for difficulty. So women get kind of a double whammy in that they're exposed to all of the same, many of the same kinds of risks as men are, whether they're in a combat situation or not. As Amy was saying, just by virtue of being in a dangerous area where there are roadside bombs and other things that are not particular to being in combat, but they also have the greater exposure to military sexual assault and possibly greater histories of military sexual assault prior to entry into the military in the first place.
I want to follow up with that. A female veteran in the Art Voice project that Jennifer participated, was that you, Tiffany, you participated in the Art Voice project. She said that, like most people in combat, she carried a rifle with her wherever she went. But she also said that because of the risk of rape, she carried her knife with her because, in her words, and this is a quote, "It's easier to explain having stabbed him rather than discharge your weapon." And that really speaks to the kind of hypervigilance these women have to deal with, and not just from the outside, but from the inside.
I think the sense of betrayal when one is assaulted by a fellow soldier also really can't be understated. There's not just the enemy from without, but people who are supposed to be part of your military family and supposed to have your back are often those who are betraying you.
Jennifer, Tiffany, I wonder if either of you would be comfortable addressing this. If not, we'll just move on.
I think she nailed it right on the head. I mean, the biggest factor is the sense of betrayal and the feeling unsafe, because these are your family. These are the people that you trust with your life. So when something like that happens, there's no explanation for it, and there's no really moving past it. I personally, not during my deployment, experienced anything like that, and I was fortunate enough where the one instance that could have turned into something else was stopped by my command immediately. I had a company commander who made advances towards me, and I didn't show up the next day for work, and my section sergeant sent me a message. He was like, "What's going on? You're always here. You're always on time. Why aren't you here?" And I explained to him that this 6'4", 275-pound bodybuilder of a man made advances and told me that I was going to have to sleep with him. And I was terrified. So I told them what was going on. They went through the proper change, and that man was removed from our company.
Yeah, I wonder how common that is or is not, that the man would be removed. You took a big risk.
I did. I took, and I was terrified. I mean, absolutely. It was a couple of weeks to really start the process, but my section sergeant, he was just an amazing, amazing human being, and he backed me up 110%, and he was willing to lose his job if he needed to make sure he protected me.
Hmm. Amy, I read a VA report that said the rate of violent sexual crimes in the military has increased by 64% since 2006. And these women are much higher risk for experiencing homelessness. Why is that, and what's being done for these women?
Well, I'm not sure which report specifically you're referring to, but I'm guessing that it's probably talking about experiences of reported sexual assault in the military. So unfortunately, we know that sexual assault has been a crime that's happened in the military for a very long time. And it's because the research is challenging to do. It's a little hard to know exactly if the rates are increasing or staying the same or decreasing over time. Certainly, we know that it's happening too frequently, regardless of exactly how happening it's frequent. We know it's too frequent. But what I've seen increasing over time, which is actually an incredibly positive thing, is that more and more people are feeling able to come forward and report their experiences in the way that it sounds like Jennifer did. I'm so pleased to hear that she had a positive experience from reporting that. And it's so critical that the victims feel able to come forward and report and talk about these experiences. So we often see that the reported experiences are increasing. It's hard to know if that means overall experiences are increasing or decreasing, but it's very important that people are now talking about these things out in the open.
And then what? What kind of treatment is available for these women?
And it is primarily women, but can also happen to men as well, unfortunately. And the Department of Veterans Affairs has a number of programs focused on treatment for survivors of military sexual trauma. So every VA hospital has a military sexual trauma coordinator whose job is to coordinate care for these veterans. What? Every veteran who walks into a VA is screened for experiences of military sexual trauma so we can identify these things, let the veterans know that we're interested in talking about them, and then every veteran can get free care at a VA for any conditions that are associated with military sexual trauma.
Wait. I have to interrupt you because Jennifer Crane and Tiffany Johnson have the misfortune of being live in the studio with me, and I can see the expressions on their face. May I turn to you, Tiffany? The expression on your face looked almost like an eye roll here. Is this the way it really works, the way Amy's?
I know that there are resources available to women once they become veterans. Just the reason I know that is because of my occupation, what I do right now. But as somebody separating from the Air Force, I didn't know that that was available. As well, I didn't know that there were a lot of resources available that I personally needed.
That was the look on your face. And what was yours, Jennifer?
Pretty much the same sentiment. I mean, I personally now know what is available for women veterans, but this is also 11 years after I came home. So there's a huge gap between being separated from the service and getting to the VA to get what you need. And I think that that's a gap we need to find a way to close. And whether that be the VA being able to find a way to, you know, collaborate with the military and be able to distribute, you know, information to them and make sure it gets to your soldiers who are coming home from overseas, and we know that these people have problems and they need help. We just there's a gap and it needs to be filled. For the most part, I completely agree with what Amy was saying. I mean, they have fantastic programs, although sometimes they're a little bit more difficult to access. And if you don't know about them, you can't use them.
We've got to talk about access, too. We've got to take a short break. Brianna Goff, we're going to talk with you when we get back about families and what can be done, what family interventions are available. And I also want to learn from both you, Janice, and you, Amy, about PTSD interventions, that especially for women. I hope we're learning a great deal, and I hope we're utilizing what we're learning to help these women, and especially the two women I'm looking at right now, right across from me. We are talking about, obviously, women in the military, trauma during and after their military experience, and we're going to be talking about what can be done, what is available, and what should be available, what still needs to be available. The ladies in the studio with me are Jennifer Crane and Tiffany Johnson, two veterans of the U.S. military. We're also with Drs. Amy Street, Brianna Nelson Goff, and Janice Krupnik, all specializing in trauma, PTSD, and military families. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Foundation offers charitable gift annuities, charitable remainder trusts, and pooled income funds. Talk to your financial advisor about how these income-generating and tax-saving tools can build resources for community organizations. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org. 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about female veterans and their experience and what's available to them. Tiffany, way back in the show, you talked about being a single mom. I wonder, we talked about what it was like for you when you left, when you were overseas. A little bit about that.
Okay. Well, if you're a single parent in the military, you have to have what they call a family care plan. So in the event that you do have to deploy, you have a plan set up of where your child is going or where your children are going, where they'll be taken care of. That wasn't a problem. I did have that thing set up. However, at that time, it wasn't the best interest of my child. I understand what my job was in the military, that my position was to deploy as needed, as they were telling me. But I did stress to my command, and I was like, you know, this is not the best situation right now for my child. So coming out of the decision in 2009 to separate from the military was the decision between either my career and my family, and I had to choose my family.
Let's go to Brianna now. Brianna's the our resident family therapist from Kansas State University. Brianna, thank you for being so patient.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
So, what are you learning about families, military families? What is being done? What needs to be done?
Well, I think there is a lot being done. Unfortunately, I think it's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, some of it is, it's always fascinating to hear the veterans' experiences, because I think they, you know, they're the ones that are living the experiences. And one of the things I think we have a number of, I'm going to go back to what we were talking about before, because I think increasingly we're finding that our communities need to be developing programs. And so even though we have, a number of programs through the VA, through the military, to address some of these issues, you know, increasingly we're finding either that people are not close to a VA or a vet center and needing to get access to services within their communities, whether that is programs that are specific to, helping them with PTSD or traumatic brain injury or military sexual assault, but really providing local providers with increased awareness and training on how to recognize the specific needs of our military. But one of the main things, I think, is ensuring that, particularly for female veterans and her sharing about the experience that she had, there are programs in place and certainly there's paperwork that they need to have. And yet the reality is for our female veterans, they're also primary caregivers oftentimes. And that may be for children, that may be for parents.
That's what I want to hear about. I want to hear about not so much the resources that are available. I want to hear about what you're doing, what we're learning about families, and if we can use, say, Tiffany, we're going to ask you to be a kind of an example here for the moment. What could you, based on what you're learning as family therapist, what could you do for Tiffany? I wonder if even before deployment, what you could have done to help make the, and certainly after she came back.
Sure, certainly. And we can't ever predict, who's going to come back with PTSD. We certainly know risk factors. But I think the biggest thing is recognizing who her support network is, and particularly for our veterans who are coming back with PTSD and other issues. Again, they shared earlier about, distancing from their family members. Even though she looked the same, she was completely different. And I think helping the family members, the spouse, the children, helping them to understand it's not just a deployment. Everyone is going to change, and that's one of the things that we know, is everyone changes during those months or years when the parent or sibling or spouse is gone.
Let me stop you there. I'm watching both Jennifer and Tiffany react. Tiffany, you first.
I just wanted to interject something right quick. I know that I wanted to talk about as far as the VA and what they could have done when I came back from my deployment. God bless that when I came back from my deployment, I wasn't homeless. However, it was something that I faced, and it was a great stressor considering that it wasn't just me. If it was just me alone, I could have dealt with that. I could have made provisions. However, I had to go through making the provisions that to make sure that my child wasn't on the street. Now, when I went to, I had a house in New Jersey, and when I went to the VA to get them to help me, to give me assistance, because between the time that I separated from the military until I separated in March, I didn't have a job until October. And between that time, of course, payments fell behind. Like you pointed out, I'm the primary caregiver. I went to the VA asking them for assistance to help me to keep my house so that I could keep that, my daughter could have that experience so she could have that stability, etc. I was told by the VA that it was not in their best interest to help me keep my house. So if that could be prevented for other females or males in the future, that would be great.
Well, I think that's a question we need to turn to Amy about. Amy, can you weigh in on this?
Mostly, that question makes me want to apologize to Tiffany. That's not something that should have happened. That shouldn't have been the response that she got in that time. The VA certainly has programs that are designed particularly for that kind of situation. I'm thinking specifically of supportive services for veterans' families. It's essentially a big chunk of funding just increased to $300 million in grants in the last year for families particularly who are at risk for homelessness. And I'm sorry that it sounds like that didn't work for Tiffany when she was seeking those services.
Yeah, I want you to be sure, Amy, to get us this information so we can put it on our webpage. I also want to say, too, we've had a lot of people calling and asking what they can do to help. And please check out our webpage. There's lots of resources. And both Jennifer and Tiffany are involved in interesting programs. And I want to make sure we have time to address, to explore both of those programs. I want to shift gears for a minute here, and I want to turn to you, Janice, about as a psychiatrist and a researcher and a clinician, what are we learning about PTSD with women, what works, what doesn't work? You've written a lot of articles about exposure therapy versus interpersonal. So translate those two concepts into American.
Okay. First, I'm a clinical psychologist, not a psychiatrist, but no problem. Not a problem. The two main treatments that have been rolled out, as it's called, in the VAs across the country for treatment of PTSD have been exposure therapy and cognitive processing therapy. And exposure therapy is basically, you know, making people confront their traumatic experiences over and over and over again as a way of kind of desensitizing them to those experiences.
And as you're saying that, both of my guests are rolling their eyes and shaking their heads no.
Right. So that is one of the main treatments that's available. And cognitive processing therapy, which is also a cognitive behavioral therapy that involves trying to think about their experiences in a different way, and also with some exposure in the form of writing about their experiences. My own approach, and I did a pilot study at the Washington D.C. VA specifically for women, because my feeling was that exposure therapy, while it can be very effective for those who stay with it, and cognitive processing therapy, which particularly had an evidence base with women who had been sexually assaulted in civilian life, while those may be effective for some people, I don't think that they're the treatment of choice for everyone. And the approach that I tried with women I saw at the VA who had PTSD from trauma that they experienced during the military was more of an interpersonal approach, which looks at some of the relationship consequences of having experienced trauma, because PTSD in and of itself involves a lot of relationship difficulties, feelings of detachment from others, heightened irritability and anger that might translate into more conflictual kinds of relationships.
Let me back you up a minute, Janice.
Sure.
PTSD... Mm-hmm. Trauma happens as a result of relationships
exactly.
Broken, betrayals or abandonment, or you know, or
exactly, which is really the focus of the adaptation of interpersonal therapy that I've developed, that I think particularly for women where there may be more of a relational focus could be another approach that could be useful in the VA system.
No, I'm telling you, as a clinician and as a clinician who reads literature on a different topic every week, there's no question about that. If the relationship's not there, you know, it's like I said to Tiffany, you know, before the show, safety is everything for this hour, and you know. Nothing happens in this show if she doesn't feel safe and Jennifer doesn't feel safe. It's about relationships.
Right, right.
It's about caring, compassionate relationships, and then put in the other stuff that needs to come in.
I completely agree.
Yeah. I want to turn now to both ladies about what projects you're involved in. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but let's start with you first, Jennifer Crane. What you been doing these days?
Oh, I've been doing a lot. Well, I wasn't a single mom while I was in the military, but I am now. I'm a single mom, two kids. My daughter just turned 6, and my son is 9 months old. I just bought my first house, And I went to school. I got my degree in nursing, and I'm working as a nurse in my local community, actually applying to the same VA that booted me out, because my hope and my dream and my goal is to work there with other vets and help people like me.
Do me a favor. Give us the cliff notes. Of how you got from there to here, that scared girl I saw 5 years ago to this grown woman on top of her life today?
Very honestly, I found some self-respect. I actually started believing in myself, and I stuck with my therapy. I've been with my therapist for 8 years. She's amazing. I wouldn't trade her for the world, and it was the best thing I've ever done with my life.
We call that a relationship.
Absolutely.
And a success.
Yes.
And a success. Tiffany, what are you up to, and how are you doing? And how's your daughter?
Oh, thank you. My daughter, she's doing well. She's been my wingman. I call her my whole military career, and we've gone through this together, but she's definitely better. Lately, I feel like I've been a productive part of society, which is the message that I want to convey, because in the media, it seems like we're portrayed. I actually read it somewhere that soldiers, returning soldiers, were ticking time bombs, and I took offense to that. I'm sure other veterans did, but what I want to say is that, you know, give us the time and then the resources that we need. We can be, and we are, productive parts of society. We can add to our relationships, community, job, etc., and be of great value, but it takes time. Some of the projects that I'm involved in, the one is the Photo Voice Project, where I've been able to take a camera and then convey, you know, through the pictures that I've taken, the things that are important to me.
We've got a minute left. I want to ask something about you and our relationship, Tiffany. How's this been, this last hour?
I was a little anxious, I admit, when I came in here and everything, but I definitely appreciate coming here and being able to feel safe. That's a big thing for me. And then I also appreciate the opportunity to be able to give my perspective and tell about my experience about the situation.
And you felt safe?
Yes, sir.
For the hour?
Mm-hmm.
And my old friend Jennifer, you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, good.
Absolutely.
Good. Me too. And you guys helped me. I want to thank all five of my guests so very, very much for the work you do, and especially Jennifer and Tiffany for who you are. You're just amazing, amazing women, and it is an honor to share this hour with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about female soldiers returning from deployment with the aforementioned Jennifer Crane and Tiffany Johnson, as well as psychologist Brianna Nelson-Goff, Janice Krupnik, and Amy Street from the VA. And we've got lots of information on our webpage. Well, to download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and we're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Thanks so much, Al, for this. Lindsay Carafagno is our summer intern. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.